Welcome to All for Business podcast, hosted by the Lynchburg Regional Business Alliance. Our goal with this show is to gather leaders from across the Lynchburg region in one place to talk about business, leadership, how our guests have found themselves here today, and much, much more. So, pop in your headphones, turn the volume up, and get ready. This is All for Business.
Hello, everyone. I'm Chael Nunn. I'm your host today for the All for Business podcast. I'm with Dr. Allison Morrison Shetland. She likes to be called President Allison. We've both been vaccinated for COVID, so we're going to take off our mask so you can see us and hear us a little bit better. This is put on by the Lynchburg Regional Business Alliance, which is the largest business association in Lynchburg. And it's large enough to do a lot of great things, but small enough for it to be like family. And it's powered by businesses, which University of Lynchburg is one of the big businesses we have. I'm Chael Nunn. I'm a retired physician executive in town. I work with Ryan Weeks, who is the Director of Communications and Marketing with the Business Alliance. And if you see me shaking or moving very much sometimes, it's because I have Parkinson's disease and the medication will tend to make me move. But anyway, the goal of these podcasts is try to break us out of this COVID cave that we have.
Yes,
we're just locked in and we don't see each other. We don't know each other. And I thought this would be a good way to introduce people to the business people in town and leaders in town to see how things are going. So welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's great to see you again and glad to be part of this podcast.
Yeah, great. I've got a lot of questions for you. And the first one I have is that, you know, when we first spoke, I mentioned to you that you had big shoes to fill. And your response to me was,
I bring my own shoes.
Bring your own shoes. And I thought that when I saw your picture in the paper this morning for being at EC Glass, mm-hmm. I said, you are stepping out in your own shoes. But what I want to ask you first about, though, are your baby shoes. Your accent's different than mine.
Yes.
So where are you from? Tell me about growing up and your parents and stuff like that.
I was born in Scotland in a place called Paisley. So if you know about the Paisley pattern,
right? Yeah,
textile industry. And grew up just my first 6 years I was in Paisley, but then my father took us to the Isle of Bute, which is an island on the west coast of Scotland.
Yeah.
And had an idyllic, growing up experience. I'm first generation. Come from a very modest background.
Right.
And so the beach and the island were my playground. We didn't do a lot of vacations. We just used whatever we had.
Right.
And so I grew up, I really enjoyed sports. So I was very much involved in basketball and field hockey and track and field. So, and I still have the long jump record at my high school because the year after I graduated, they removed the long jump pit. So that's my claim to fame on the island.
Well, where in Scotland is that island again? What part of the region?
So if you think about Glasgow,
uh-huh.
and then Paisley's just a little bit to the south of Glasgow.
Right.
And then the island, there's a River Clyde that runs through Glasgow,
right.
goes down to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
In the River Clyde, mouth of the River Clyde, there's three islands. Arran, Cumbrae, and Bute.
Oh, yeah.
And I was brought up on Bute.
Okay.
And I was there until I was 18 years old and then moved to Dundee College of Technology,
yep.
which is all the way over on the other side of the country.
Well, I think
two and a half hours away.
You're up there toward Carnoustie.
No. Yeah. We're definitely west coast Scotland.
Okay.
And so, I grew up there, 18 years old, left to go to Dundee. Ostensibly, to do a technical degree.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a technician in a lab. I loved biology, loved the sciences, all of that good stuff. And when I got to Dundee, they said to me, if you just take one more chemistry O-level, you should do your Bachelor of Science.
Right.
And it was that mentoring and that suggestion, hey, you can do this,
right.
That started me on my career, really starting to do my Bachelor of Science. And then after 4 years, I had money for 4 years,
uh-huh.
and that was it.
Uh-huh.
And I finished my undergraduate degree with no debt.
Okay.
And then they invited me to come back and be the first group of students for a PhD program.
Right.
So I started my PhD program. I had money for 3 years, mm-hmm. and that was it. So I graduated with my PhD when I was
24. 3 years. That's pretty quick, wasn't it?
Yeah. In Britain, you don't do classes. Usually when you finish your undergraduate degree, you're sort of at a master's level. Mm-hmm. And so I just went straight into my PhD and straight into research. So I did 3 years of research and then wrote my thesis up very quickly and got finished in time to get a job in London.
So what was your next step was to teach?
No, I wanted to be a researcher. Okay. I wanted to be a researcher so badly. I thought my whole future was I was going to be in a lab. I was going to be doing discoveries in science and right. it was just going to be great. And I didn't have to talk to anybody. Because one of the other things you might not know about me, Chal, is that I am very, very shy.
Okay. I couldn't tell that. You don't seem shy to me. Yeah.
So for me, yes, it was a science career. So I went to London for 3 years, worked in a research lab there, working on skin cell differentiation, actually growing skin cells in culture
right.
and looking at those kinds of right. things for skin grafting, although I was doing the basic research component. Great 3 years. And then I was invited to come to Dortmund in Germany uh-huh. to a Max Planck Institute there. Yeah. Because literally it was, you know, what do you want to do when you finish your postdoc? And right. I was like, well, I don't really know. Where would you like to come to Germany? Oh, sure. And that's really how it happened. I haven't really applied for a job almost my whole career. People uh-huh. have, again, seen something in me that right. they thought was, you know, of use to them and uh-huh. also allowed me a growing experience. So 7 years in Germany.
And then you came to the States.
Yes. Well, while I was in Germany, I met and married a man from Kansas.
Okay.
Yeah. Tried very hard to meet people so I could speak German right. and learn German because I didn't speak German when I went to Germany. And but then I happened upon this wonderful guy called Bob Schettler.
Yeah.
And he's also a biologist.
Okay.
He came to Germany to work with my boss.
Right.
And do his PhD. So uh-huh. he actually got his PhD in Germany. So we met, married. And then after about 6 years, we decided to come to the States, and that was in 1993.
Did you come to the Southeast to start with, like Georgia and Florida?
I actually started in Connecticut.
Okay.
Bob got a job at Farmington Health Center uh-huh. in the pediatrics department uh-huh. and doing basic research. Yeah. And I started working at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. And I was there for 2 years. And then started in Georgia, at Georgia Southern University. Was there for 7 years. Start to see a pattern.
Right, yeah.
Central Florida. Went yeah. to Central Florida. Was there for 8 years and had three different positions.
I've been on that campus. It's a very large school.
It mm-hmm. is. When I went yeah. to UCF, it was 38,000 students.
Right.
When I left, it was just under 60,000. But John Hitt was the president, just did yeah. an amazing job.
Yeah.
And he was a great mentor for me as well.
Right.
And as a result from that position, I started as the director of professional development for faculty.
Right.
Moved into the dean of undergraduate studies position and uh-huh. then became vice provost and dean of undergraduate studies
okay.
when I was there. And that then catapulted me to go to Elon University.
Right.
And there I was there for 4 years as the dean of arts and sciences.
Okay. And, I'm trying to, being a physician, I practice medicine, and then I just made a big decision. Say, I'm going to jump into leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the hospital nearby and said, hire me. This is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of created my own job.
Mm-hmm.
How did you break out of being the professor to being the boss of the professor? And I imagine my managing positions is very similar to your managing academic with tenure.
It is. I still think I'm a faculty member
yeah.
because I still teach every day. It's just a different kind of teaching.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe that my role is to create an environment where everyone else can be successful.
Yeah.
And so I'm like you. I've created my jobs. You know, there's certain things that you have to do, right?
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
certain administrative things, there's certain teaching things you have to do. But for me, it was always, what could I do to expand what was already being done?
Right.
And I, again, firmly believe that I'm on this planet to create educational environments where other people can meet their maximum potential.
Right.
So it didn't really matter what my title was. It didn't matter what my area was. It was just something that I wanted to make sure that I could affect other people's lives. I call myself a servant leader. And mm-hmm. that is why I think I was put on this planet to help other people.
What was your first real leadership job that you did. You know, when you think about it, when it became you in charge of executing the vision, putting together the team and stuff like that.
Really, again, it's been throughout my teaching career because I've developed programs, I've created grant opportunities, undergraduate research, those kinds of things. So I've been in charge of programs probably most of my career.
Yeah.
My first leadership title was when I was department head in Germany. I was 30 years old. I was asked to create a department basically from nothing.
Right.
And grew that from two people. I started with a technician, and we ended up with about 8 or 9 researchers.
So it was incremental, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think it always is. And leadership, again, you know, titled or untitled, is always in, I think, in a person.
Yeah.
You can lead in your church, you can lead in your community, you can do various things. You don't need to have a title to be a leader.
Right. So do you have a particular leadership philosophy other than being a servant leader that you just talked to me about?
That is my philosophy. I love the whole servant leadership ideals. I love, you know, sometimes leading from in front,
right,
where you're out championing whatever the cause is, and you are the face of that.
Yeah.
I love leadership from beside, where we can all get together, bring our own strengths and skills to the table.
Right.
And then what emerges is more beautiful than the original idea.
Yeah.
My favorite position is from leadership from behind, where you can have identified people who have strengths that are different from yours, put them forward, support them to success, and then stand back and just watch people grow and develop. And I love that. And I think that's what a president is. I think it's what a dean or anyone who really believes in making sure that other people have those leadership opportunities.
Do you have any particular vision for what you want to do here? Mm-hmm. I know when I went into my leadership, I had, these are 3 things I want to make happen.
Mm-hmm.
It often takes years to see the results.
Yeah.
It's a delayed gratification. So do you have a particular vision or things that you want to achieve?
Absolutely. When I came here, and we had talked a little bit about this before, but I was announced as the president-elect back in November of 2019.
Yeah.
And from then until March, I was on campus all the time. And my big thing to do was to talk to all the students, all the faculty, all the staff, the community, and to start to see what themes emerged as how people saw this institution.
Yeah.
I read the strategic plan. I looked at, you know, what we'd done in the past. I looked at where our budget went, because I really think if you understand the budget, you understand the values of the institution.
Yeah.
So that was a really good experience for me. And then from March until when I actually started August 1st, I went virtual. And I talked to over 600 people to say, why did you come to Lynchburg? Why did you stay at Lynchburg?
Mm-hmm.
And what emerged from that was, we do a great job here at leadership development for the students.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do a great job for faculty and staff. And so I really saw that as something that we could build on, an area of distinction, something that we can include the community in. And so that emerged as one of my 3 pillars. The second pillar was, this is an incredibly innovative place.
Right.
The faculty and the staff are just amazing. They're nimble. They want to see things progress. So the second pillar became innovation and collaboration.
Yeah.
Because again, the University of Lynchburg is Lynchburg's university.
Right.
And we are here to serve our community. We're here to educate people on how to be good citizens.
Yeah.
And so that became my second pillar,
innovation
and collaboration. And then the third pillar is something that I've been working on all of my life, is to create environments where people are respected and valued for what they bring to the table.
Right.
And that diversity, that equity, that inclusion is really important to me. Again, first generation, modest background.
Right.
I wouldn't be where I am today without people who have donated scholarship dollars, who have provided grants, who have provided federal funding. And so to be able to create an environment, which is what we are doing here, that everyone can come here, doesn't matter who you are, you will find a place here. You'll find people that are family. This will become your home. So those are my 3 pillars of my presidency. And we're already well on our way to doing that and incorporating them into a new strategic plan.
How are you working with your faculty to develop them in their leadership? Because you're not teaching students leadership, you want to teach your faculty leadership.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing that? What are you doing differently to make that happen?
So first of all, I've got to find out what people want in terms of their skills. And I firmly believe, you know, people say, I don't know what I don't know. Well, since I was in professional development for 8 years, it's pretty easy for me to say, ask the right questions and then pull out from them, what is it that they're feeling that they're lacking or they're not confident in? Mm-hmm. So we're developing a leadership academy, mm-hmm. which will allow faculty and staff to have a year-long program mm-hmm. Where they can learn from others about what leadership is all about. We can talk about philosophies, we can read books, we can
right.
study that. More importantly, we can practice it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm looking for. And so I want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to see themselves in this institution as a mm-hmm. leader right. and provide those opportunities.
Right. Are you going to have your own faculty teacher or faculty here, sort of keep it in-house, or you can do a little outside stuff too?
We have such strength in leadership development on this campus, whether it's right. in the School of Business, in our educational leadership programs. Faculty people like Roger Jones, who's been teaching leadership for mm-hmm. years and years and years. Right. So there's a lot of strength here already.
Yeah.
A lot of strength.
Yeah. When the reason I asked you a lot about this is that as a physician going into leadership, I had no training in the early 90s. So where did I turn? And there's an organization called the American College of Physician Executives. Mm-hmm. And they existed just to bring doctors up into leadership skills. And I eventually got on board there with the president there after many years. I got a master's degree through them. But we would develop leadership skills for doctors, and they would come away and spend a week with us. We bring business school professors in and teach them over the year. So I think organizations have struggled how to scale that up, how to scale it up within your own institution. So I was just curious about how you would scale it up here to where it's effective.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're looking at, again, based on my own experience, I used to run week-long leadership programs for faculty.
Right.
And we based it in very much an experiential learning, so it was more of an outdoor program,
right.
as well as obviously readings and discussions. And that's what I want to bring here. It's almost like an outdoor leadership experience. It can be a weekend, it can be a day, it can be half a day.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at day-long opportunities, weekend-long opportunities, week-long opportunities, and then moving that into, particularly for people on campus, year-long opportunities uh-huh. where people can step into people's footsteps and look to see what they can learn from individuals. And we have amazing leaders on this campus.
Yeah.
So there's lots of role modeling, and there's lots of opportunity for pairing people up and really talking right. about how to improve their right. leadership potential.
Yeah. On your leadership career, can you tell me about a particular challenge or a big challenge you have to overcome? It was particularly difficult.
COVID.
Let's talk about COVID. How did it affect the place? Mm-hmm. What did you have to do?
Well, again, I'm so blessed that I had the opportunity to come onto campus before March of last year.
Yeah.
And as a result, really got to know people. But what I saw when I came here was a strong leadership, strong ability to be nimble mm-hmm. and to basically make sure we were up in the literature and make sure we were doing right things for our students and our right. faculty and staff. And so the number one thing we did was develop a health plan.
Yeah.
And once we established a rigorous health plan, we knew what we needed to do. We knew we were reading from the CDC and following VDH guidelines, Virginia Department of Health guidelines.
Yeah.
Then we put that in place. And then all the policies and procedures fell into place after that.
Right.
And so that challenge for me was, I didn't really know these people.
Right.
So I'm walking in, taking on a leadership role really before I became the president.
Yeah.
Dr. Garing was absolutely fabulous and sort of said, you are, going to be the next leader. You're going to be executing this stuff.
Right,
so,
right.
Get in there and get the work done. And so to see the leaders on this campus step forward, to see people say, I want to be part of this team. I want to make this happen because we wanted to be a residential face-to-face campus
right.
on August 9th of last year. And that was the biggest challenge for me because working with people I didn't know
right.
very rapidly got me to know people.
Yeah.
And for me to see what an amazing group of people here are here and how they came together and really made things happen.
So you had on campus the whole time?
Yes.
And would you say you were at full capacity on campus?
So we are. All of our students return from first to second year. In
right.
fact, our retention rate increased.
Yeah.
So we went from 75% to 78%
yeah.
of our first to second year retention. We were able to adjust our classroom settings. We were able to make sure that we had 6 feet apart and all that kind of thing. And we did that through going into a hybrid mode, So did some online
split
work?
Split it up. And
But then I had students in the classroom because they want to be in the classroom. They want to be there with their faculty and staff. We very early on identified the fact that transmission of the virus did not occur in the classrooms.
Okay.
It was all occurring in the residence
hall. Right. Residence hall and social.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
And the reason we were successful is the students did everything that we asked them to do. They wanted to be on campus. They wanted to be with their peers. They wanted to be with their faculty and staff. And as a result, we did have a peak. I will never forget August 28th.
Yeah.
Because at that point in time, we had 46 positives on campus and 130 people in quarantine.
Yeah.
But we coped with it. Everything went really, really well. And we were able to adapt because of the DVH guidelines and CDC guidelines.
Where do you stand today as far as number of infected in quarantine?
So as of today, I looked this morning, we have one positive student on campus. We have zero in quarantine, and we have no faculty and staff that are positive.
Let's hope it stays that way. Most people getting their vaccine?
Yes, we've been great. We've had two mass vaccination clinics on campus. I heard yesterday that we've served over 600 students with vaccines.
Yeah.
And we had 222 faculty and staff vaccinated on campus.
Okay.
But a lot of them have been vaccinated in the community. I personally went to the Jubilee Center and got my vaccination. Today is my 2 weeks out from my second vaccination.
I'm going today to volunteer the vaccine clinic here. Do you think that COVID has been, it can accelerate change? I've seen it in the healthcare industry where we accelerated perhaps telemedicine.
Mm-hmm.
Is it accelerated change for you in doing different things?
Absolutely.
In the Zoom meetings and all that kind of stuff.
We've had to change. And what I have found is that we find the things that add value to an education, and those are the things we'll keep.
Right.
People have been incredibly innovative here.
Yeah.
The dining hall has always been amazing in the community. Any of our leftover food goes into the community on a daily basis, so there's no waste. But we went to grab and go because at one point in time, August, we had to not be gathering and we couldn't have people in the dining hall. So we did grab and go.
Right.
And when we started, after 2 weeks, we said, okay, now we can go back to having dining only for students. Faculty and staff weren't allowed in dining. And the students said, no, keep the grab and go. We love to get our food, go out onto the deck, get out into the Dell.
Yeah.
Let's keep that going. So that's one of the things that we're doing. One of many, basically, that we think add value.
Did it affect the SAT using that as an admission criteria? Have you always used that as an admission criteria here, or are you still going to use it? I think I looked in your online, you're not requiring it this year.
Right. So we went test optional last year before COVID.
Before COVID,
And so you didn't have to submit your ACTs or your SATs when you submit your application to come here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most schools are test optional.
Yeah.
And as a result, people are applying to institutions that they never thought they would apply to before because they think that they're not going to take their, because they're not going to take their SATs or ACT scores.
Right.
But then they go on a wait list. And I read just this morning that there's, you know, people have huge, huge wait lists.
Yeah.
And as a result, some institutions, applications are dying.
Oh, okay.
And we're one of those. Our applications are down, but the quality of students who are applying here is actually increased.
Yeah.
And so their GPAs, which is really the strongest indicator of the success of a student at an institution, is really what we're looking for.
Okay. When you look at a student coming in, you know, I think the educational system in the United States is different than Europe. We have a lot of focus on athletics as part of school and part of college. That's not the way it is in Europe, I don't think. They don't emphasize sports so much. So where sports come outside of the school experience.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the, I'm looking at here at the lacrosse field. What do you think of sports and college? Is it positive? Is it negative? Is it pros and cons or your European experience? What do you think?
Well, I played basketball in college when I was in Britain. There was no scholarships.
Right.
It was all extracurricular.
Yeah.
One of the things that brought me to Lynchburg was the fact that 80% of our students, I'll say that one more time, 80% of our students are involved in collegial, club, or intramural sports.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is a pretty healthy campus.
Yeah.
There's lots going on. Schellenberger Field, the lights are on from early in the morning till late at night.
Yeah.
As we do practices and then this, I say college and intramural sports, club and intramural sports. And so that's a big thing for us.
Yeah.
We're a pretty healthy campus. 40% of our students are recruited through athletics. Again, it's a large number.
It's a large number.
But there are no scholarships. Students are coming here to play the sport.
Mm-hmm.
And from my own experience and what I see here at Lynchburg, it's a great way for leadership development.
Yeah, that's what I was
going to
say.
Yeah, it's a great way for people to come, you know, from all sorts of places and really mm-hmm. meet people very quickly.
Right.
And there's a discipline that comes with playing a sport.
No.
It's not just something, oh, I'll go and do it now, you know. In between things, you've got to plan. So your time management skills have to be very strong.
Yeah.
And we know that people who are very, very good in the classroom are very good on the field, track and field. Mm-hmm. And so when we compare our GPAs for our athletes to our general body,
mm-hmm.
they're higher. The retention rate for students who are involved in athletics is higher. Mm-hmm. And their satisfaction with the university is higher. And so, to me, it's a really important component of our educational experience.
So you're suggesting that people in Europe think about integrating athletics into your curriculum, perhaps?
Well, I don't think I have any influence over the British educational system.
You mentioned you learn leadership in athletics. You learn discipline, which I think is really, and that helps you educationally, academically. I've always felt that it played a big role in equity and inclusion. I grew up in the South here during Jim Crow days. And when we integrated the schools, I played sports, so I was automatically integrated. And the arts and sports brings you together with other people. Whereas if you typically, if you're not in sports, you don't have quite as much of that. So I've always felt that it helped a lot with equity and inclusion.
I agree with you. I think a liberal arts education helps you with equity and inclusion.
Yeah.
There are no barriers
if
you open things up for discussion. And that's one of the things we do really well here at the University of Lynchburg is we encourage people to have open, courteous, respectful dialogue
mm-hmm.
about anything.
Yeah.
And so when the time comes for difficult situations to be discussed,
right.
they arise in our community, they arise in our country, and we really bring people together around a program we call Courageous Conversations. And that has integrated a lot of people with very different viewpoints to sit down and say, oh, okay, well, I hadn't thought about that perspective.
Right.
I hadn't thought about it through that lens. And that has helped us tremendously. So we've done a lot with integration of diversity of thought,
right.
which for me is the number one kind of diversity.
Right. You know, I've on this podcast, I want to interview many politicians. But I want to do it in a way where it's not political,
mm-hmm.
to where we can have courageous conversations and to try to see if we can talk to each other respectfully. And tell me more about courageous conversations, what you're doing about that here.
It's a program that has been going on now for a couple of years, but mm-hmm. we really strengthened it in this last year, particularly around COVID.
Yeah.
Because it's caused people to be more isolated than we would like them to be. So
right.
it's a way to bring people together, whether virtually or on the Dell, which is where my preference is
right.
to have these conversations. And we just bring the topics to
right.
the table.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about this? What do you think about that?
Right.
I'll give you a good example. Frankie Slaughter, who's an artist in Richmond
right.
and actually knows this area really very well. She produced a piece that has everything from George Floyd's name on it,
uh-huh.
COVID, masks. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And if you get a chance to look at it before you leave, you really should.
Yeah.
And we've used that piece as a way to bring artists together to
yeah.
talk about society, societal issues, and include our students, faculty, and staff in those conversations. So we're looking at societal issues through art, through music, through the humanities, so historical perspectives,
right.
Poetry,
mm-hmm.
And then the sciences and math.
Yeah.
Bring all of these things together. How do we talk about difficult conversations?
Mm-hmm.
And they're led by faculty. They're
yeah.
led by students.
Mm-hmm.
And they're rich discussions.
Mm-hmm.
And we capture them all on video so that you can go and look at them afterwards.
Yeah. I get the feeling that a courageous conversation has to be an in-depth conversation.
Oh, yes.
But in today's world, the sound bites trump complexity every time. You cannot talk about a complex subject. You just throw something out. That's terrible. That's cancel culture. That's woke. They're using one of defund police. They're using two words or three words to try to give an impression that you can't have a conversation after that. And that's as far as you go.
Yeah. Well, we train people to do this. When doing student leaders coming in and starting conversations, we give them the tools that they need.
Yeah.
The faculty, because they're used to didactic conversations, yeah, have the tools to be able to do that. But it's all in the questioning. It's like your questions, oh, yeah, right? You're trying to get to the depth of a subject.
Right.
And people need to learn how to do that. And that's, yeah, what a liberal arts education does. It allows you to think more deeply, to ask the right questions,
right,
to delve into something, but then also to be able to listen.
You gotta listen.
Yeah. And if you can't listen, or you can't adjust your ideas, you don't have to agree in everything.
Yeah.
But you do need to understand and listen.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like doing this interview. I have thoughts about what I want to ask you, but I've got to listen to what you say so I know where it is most logical to flow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, courageous conversations. I think that's really good. We'll talk more about that later.
Okay.
Share with me your initial impressions of Lynchburg. How do you categorize it? Like, what do you think? I know there's pros and cons everywhere. What is your feeling about the college and about the community and that kind of thing?
I was excited to come here.
Yeah.
Came somewhat clandestinely before, mm-hmm, my interview. Had a look around.
You do, and that's what I do too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always scouting around,
yeah,
outside of the official channel.
Oh, absolutely. When people don't know you, they tell you things that,
right,
you know, they don't realize that maybe you shouldn't know.
Right.
Or they tell you the successes of a place, and that wouldn't normally come out in conversation. So I came here, did a lot of research before, uh-huh, I came here. So excited about the Arts Academy, so excited about the environment outdoors. My husband and I are great hikers and kayakers, and we love the fact that Clayton Nature Center is part of the university, and there's, you know, 420 acres that are just rich with opportunity.
Right. Yeah.
But the surrounding area was really, really interesting to me, and that's when I started doing these conversations with community members,
uh-huh,
with parents of students who are here, with students, etc., to find out what the community was like.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with it. First day I walked onto campus was homecoming.
Yeah.
And people didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
Didn't need to know who I was.
Yeah.
And I sat in the Dell. I sat in a red Adirondack chair, phoned, yeah, my husband and said, they better offer me the job because I want to make this place my home.
Yeah.
So it was an immediate thing for me.
That's
and
good.
As I talk more with the community,
yeah,
and become more part of the community,
right,
even though it's been mostly virtual,
yeah,
I found that, you know, people are working on great things, things that I'm passionate about, food poverty and housing, mm-hmm, insecurity.
Right.
Those are things that Bob and I have been involved in for years. Bob's been invited to be on boards. I've been invited to be on boards.
Yeah.
So really getting into the community. And the more I find out, the more I love it.
Well, I've been here 20 years, and I wasn't sure I'd be here that long. May break your 7-year rule, right?
Oh, well, I don't necessarily have a 7-year rule per se, but there is a pattern there.
Yeah. I think this is a great place to live. And for some of the reasons, as I said in our introduction, it's big enough to do a lot of great things, small enough to feel like family where you know everybody.
Yeah.
And
everybody's been so welcoming.
Right.
And EC Glass yesterday,
right,
when we went to celebrate our alumni who are teachers at EC Glass, that, you know, we had 23 people come out, and then the student interns came out. Folks were sort of stopping us and saying, "What are you doing?"
Mm-hmm.
It was just great. Everybody's been so welcoming, and being able to talk with the leaders in the community and,
right,
see what the University of Lynchburg can do to support and help Lynchburg City and the region grow and develop is really important to me.
You know, for you to get to where you are today, you had to have had some great mentors or someone, you mentioned this earlier, someone that put a positive word in your ear to make you think, I can do this. That's happened to me. It seems like this will intersect with someone who says something about you that you go, I never thought about that. And just keep, can you name one or two, anybody in particular, or get described one?
Oh my gosh. There are so many. that have helped me on my pathway. Mm-hmm. And that's why I feel strongly about giving back to that. And so I think about Terry Hickey and John Hitt, who John Hitt was the president at UCF and Terry Hickey was the provost.
Yeah.
Both of them saw things in me that I didn't see in myself and encouraged me to do things. Terry Hickey was the one that said to me, "You don't know what you don't know." Right. So let me help you. You need to be at this table. You need to hear this. You need to be part of this group. So those were two huge mentors for me professionally.
Yeah.
On the personal side, everyone has been a mentor to me. As I look to say, you know, I don't have that skill or I would like to be able to do that, what are the characteristics of that person has?
Right.
And that's where servant leadership came in. I saw people who were doing servant leadership really, really well. And I wanted to be like them. I aspired to be like them. And so I learned from them. But as you build those relationships, you know, something comes across your table and they say, "Oh, this is something that Allison should be involved in."
Right.
And that's what's happening here. Right. Now it's been interesting to, you need to be on United Way board. You need to be involved in community engagement.
Right.
That's why I met Marjorie Upjohn and Christine Kennedy.
We saw each other at the 5 p.m. runway.
Exactly. So. Exactly.
Right.
So those are the kinds of things that I think that people mentor me every day and sometimes I don't even know it. And I mentor people every day and sometimes I don't know it. Because something that you do, that one tapping on the shoulder, reaching out a hand of welcome and support, can make a huge influence in people's lives.
Well, you haven't convinced me you're a shy person yet.
I'm a recovering shy person.
I want one final question before we take a break. Is that, you know, explain to me the hierarchy of deans in the academic system, provost, dean, and I always think about a typical executive organization, CEO, and it's executive VP, and senior VP, and VP.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be the same, just different names.
It is exactly the same and different names. So the president, of course, is the CEO.
Right.
The provost is the sort of next in line.
Chief operating officer.
Chief academic.
Okay.
Officer,
okay.
First of all, but it's provost and VP for academic affairs. And so the VP for academic affairs oversees all the academic, but the provost is really second in command to the president and is the person who steps in if the president is not available.
Right.
And the reason that people call me President Allison, as opposed to just Allison or Dr. Morrison Chetler, is that our provost is also Allison.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And so it's
so
President Allison,
Provost
Allison. And that just stuck with the students.
Okay.
And Morrison Chetler's kind of difficult to
say. Well, it's hard. Yeah, I told you somebody in my family has a hyphenated last name. It's hard to say.
It is. It really is. So I'm just happy with that. I have six VPs that are over various areas.
Right.
And then what I say, first amongst equals. So the provost is first amongst those VPs,
right.
She's second in command. And then we have deans who are, you know, oversee different areas within the academic colleges.
Assistant
deans. Yeah. So it's very much the same. It's just different titles.
Okay. Let's take a brief break, man. We'll be back in a minute and continue this discussion.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
Welcome back, and we'll continue our interview with Dr. Allison Morrison Chetler here at University of Lynchburg. I know I was going to ask you. I always want to say Lynchburg College.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like at the business alliance, we all want to say the chamber.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so we stick with the name that's always been there. And that physician executive organization has changed the name to American Association of Physician Leadership. But I can't say the word. Are you having people always say the college or your LC?
Absolutely. And I'm fine with that. I meet with so many alumni and they say, well, you know, LC. And I said, I'm fine with that. It's your alma mater. You call it what you want. But I'll call it the University of Lynchburg.
Right.
And quite honestly, Chad, I just say Lynchburg and then I don't pick anybody off.
Right. Well, it's kind of like I say the Chamber of the Alliance, but I don't think anybody never ticked off of that. One thing I want to get into you to finish this up is about my idea of the education bubble. And the problem with debt for a diploma. There's been a real estate bubble that popped in 2008. I think there's a healthcare bubble that should pop because the inflationary cost of healthcare is much more than a normal inflation rate. And I think the same thing has happened in education. It's gotten prohibitively expensive. kids come out with debts that are equal to their home. As you said earlier, you had no debt for school. I was lucky when I went to Duke, it was only $5,000 a year. My parents could afford that. So I came out with no debt. And I worked hard to make sure my kids came out with no debt. Because I think that's the best thing you can give them. So my question to you is what do you think about the cost? Are we teaching the way we should? Are there alternatives to things we ought to think about that's more affordable? How would you, it's a big question. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a firm believer in access to education, a high quality education. And, you know, when you look at the sticker price of an institution, that often puts people's, you know, minds to say, I can't afford to go.
Right.
So one of the things that we've done recently is we've done what we call a reset. And a reset on our pricing has brought us from $56,000 a year to $45,000 a year, with an average cost to come here of $24,000. People don't think that. They see the $45,000 or what it used to be, the $56,000, and say, can't do it. Well, one of the things I want to emphasize is that, you know, when you fill in the FAFSA, then that gets you financial aid.
Right.
When you apply for scholarships, and we provide, you know, all of our students get some scholarship from the university or through endowed scholarships.
Right.
But only 18% of our students get endowed scholarships, and I want to try and increase that, again, to make sure that people are investing in the future of our students and of our planet, basically. And so 100% of our students that come to Lynchburg get financial aid.
Yeah.
And then a high percentage of our students get endowed scholarships and scholarships from the university.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings it down to about $24,000.
Right.
If you live in Lynchburg and don't need room and board, you can come to the University of Lynchburg for anywhere between $9,000 to $11,000.
Okay.
That is very competitive with community colleges or other, very much so with other universities even in our region.
Yeah.
So I want people to know that when you look at an institution, don't just look at the sticker price. Look at what you can get to move things around, which is what I did.
Yeah.
I got financial aid, I got scholarships, I got grants, and resulted in me leaving with no debt.
Yeah.
My parents didn't contribute very much to my education.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't in a position to be able to do that.
Right.
But what they did, and then I also worked, you know. So I was able to come out and do the things that I wanted to do,
right?
But then focus very much on my education,
right?
And that's what I want from people here.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to leave with low debt, and there's always going to be a little bit of debt because I want a little bit of skin in the game.
Right.
I think that helps people retain people, show the value of what they're doing, and so for me that's an important thing. And we try and explain to people that, you know, look at what the total cost would be to you, and you might be surprised that by bringing all these things together, you could leave with very little debt.
Right.
And that our students are leaving with some debt, but they're able to pay it off because they're getting good jobs, sometimes before they graduate,
right,
and certainly after they graduate, or they're going on to graduate schools, sometimes with a full tuition reimbursement.
Right.
Yeah, and I just talked to the SGA president, Student Government Association president, and they're going to NC State at no cost.
Right.
Because they've really been, you know, working hard here,
right,
they've got a good degree, they've got lots of experiences under their belt, and they're somebody that NC State wants to have.
Right.
So I think that's the way we need to be thinking. We need to be helping people see how they can make education affordable,
right,
be more transparent with that, because saying, here's what we cost, really is not helping people come to the University of Lynchburg, and
right,
we want them to come here.
But, you know, thinking a little different, that's a great story about how to make college affordable, your liberal arts, and you know, to help go to the next step.
Mm-hmm.
What about those that don't want to go to college, don't need to go to college? Is there a way to have people make a living wage and do very well without ever having been to college?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm a great believer in an educational highway.
Yeah.
So you're on a highway, and you're going at 60 miles an hour or more. And then there's these on-ramps.
Yeah.
And I believe that different people are at different stages in their lives, come on through a different on-ramp.
Yeah.
So we have a really strong relationship with our school system, mm-hmm. with the community college right. system, mm-hmm. to be with other institutions that might be offering things that we are not offering, because we're not offering everything, mm-hmm. right? And that's not where we are.
Right.
We're very focused on what we do and what we do well.
Mm-hmm.
And so these on-ramps are really important. So if you want to go into a profession where you don't need a degree, then what is the qualification that you need? Do you need a certification? Do you need
right.
work experience?
Right.
You know, that's an on-ramp.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find is that we provide these on-ramps for people, then they may go on and realize that they could get a degree.
Yeah.
But they may never need a degree for what they choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of it is you can start on a career that might not need a degree and start to want to increase and go through the management mm-hmm. levels.
Right.
And what we provide here are certifications that are independent of a degree.
Yeah.
That people can come and say, okay, well, if I learn how to do X, if I put three courses together, mm-hmm. I can apply for a national certification. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a concrete example. If you want to be better as an and move into accounting,
mm-hmm.
you might not want to get a degree in accounting.
Yeah.
You should be able to get a certification that gets you to the next level.
Right.
Okay. And then once you've done that for a few years, well, you know, I've got all this work experience. That work experience should count towards a degree. And we're a university that looks at work experience and counts that in terms of credits towards a degree.
Yeah.
So there's lots of on-ramps for people. And I think that's really important. I told you at the beginning, I wanted to be a technician.
Yeah.
I wanted to get a higher national diploma
right.
and be a technician for
right.
the rest of my life.
I know when you first answered that question, I was thinking that's mm-hmm. what you and I are going right. to be in.
Yep.
Academic traditional college and PhD stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but it was somebody who said, get that one little credential. That's just all you need. And then you can do your Bachelor of Science.
Right. Right.
Okay. Well, you got your Bachelor of Science, you know, what about doing your PhD? And I can tell you, when somebody said a doctorate, I was like,
yeah.
I can't do a doctorate. No. And then people showed me, oh yeah, absolutely you can.
Sometimes I wonder if that curriculum is too, is not focused enough to be like, maybe you should do something in 3 years rather than four. We are doing too many things that aren't important. And an example I use is my medical school too. We did 1 year basic science and went straight into clinical work. Whereas most medical schools did 2 years of basic science before you went into clinical work. And I felt the 1 year was enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I learned what I needed to learn. I really very rarely use that act, which is the clinical experience that really is what you learn. So I wonder, even in high school, when I was on the school board for secondary education, you know, when you would, you'd have so many English and so many this, so many that, I was thinking, do you really need all that? Is all that necessary if they are proficient?
Mm-hmm.
Can you change it to where they can then go into other things if they are a different ramp?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
that, to me, is the strength of a liberal arts education.
Mm-hmm.
A liberal arts education is not a cluster of courses. It's a way of teaching. It's a way of thinking. It's a way mm-hmm. of learning. And you mentioned, child, the clinical component of it, the
mm-hmm.
hands-on experiential
yeah,
learning.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's what a liberal arts education is all about.
Right.
We have students doing undergraduate research, internships, service learning, study abroad. All of those experiences, take what you're learning in the classroom, but actually apply it. And the kind of ways that we teach are ways in which you use what you're learning and you see the relevance of it.
Right.
So a liberal arts education is a way of learning, a way of thinking. It's not a series of courses that all come together.
Okay. Let me wrap this up with a few more personal things. Tell me, what's your favorite thing to do in Lynchburg when you're not working?
So I'm out there hiking, out enjoying things. We haven't been able to go to any of the arts and the performances
right.
and do any of those things we absolutely love to do. So I can't wait until everything starts to open up again and we can actually go to performances.
Right.
Both Bob and I are really into the arts. We're really into music, although
yeah.
we're both scientists.
Yeah.
And personally, if I want to be by myself and do something creative, I'm a quilter.
And, oh, you are cool.
Yeah, I'm a quilter. I love to do fabric art. Oh my gosh. And that's my zen.
Yeah.
And so Sundays are my day for myself where I can do what I need to do for my own spiritual and personal growth, and quilting is that. We like to hike and we like to be, we can't wait to bring our kayaks up and get out and do some kayaking.
Yeah.
Just being outdoors.
Yeah.
It's just fabulous here.
Tell me about your family.
So I have a husband and a dog.
Okay.
So Bob is the first gentleman at the University of Lynchburg, and Molly is the first dog. And we like to be out and about and meeting and greeting people. We're on campus a lot. In fact, this afternoon, this is a wellness day. Since we didn't have spring break, we have wellness days here on campus. And so Bob and I are going to be out giving students healthy snacks and unhealthy snacks probably as well. But helping them relax and energize and re-energize.
Is Bob working or is he being the first man?
He is the first gentleman. He's comes with me to lots of things, and he's also on several boards, both in the community and on campus. But he is retired. He decided to retire early and be less support for me.
Well, maybe he'll start a podcast like this.
Well, maybe.
That's what he does.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure. I'm glad we got a chance to meet beforehand during this. I've learned a lot from you. And what I've learned in these podcasts is the people I've met, it's incredible the talent that we have in this town. The people I've talked to so far and what they know, what they bring to the table. And that's another reason why Lynchburg is a great place to live. So thank you very much. And thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of All for Business podcast, hosted by the Lynchburg Regional Business Alliance. The Alliance is a Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development organization serving the Lynchburg region and over 750 member organizations. To learn more about what we do in our other programs, please visit lynchburgregion.org. See you next time!